Hello, yes, hello, welcome, hello, welcome, hello, 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 welcome. This is Literally Loitering, part of the Geek Show Podcast Network. We are the Geek Show's dedicated arts and books and theatre and culture and, well, as you'll quickly come to learn, all sorts of stuff podcast. My name's Graham, and this week I've been joined by Rob.
Hello.
Sarah.
Hello.
And Andrew.
Welcome. There, broke the hello chain.
Now, regular listeners will know that we like to start off with a bit of a throwback to a story we've covered on the show before, and this might be the fastest it's ever happened, because it is my solemn duty to report that after the last episode, Maurizio Cattelan's golden toilet was stolen.
That's right.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
I was reading something about this.
Hang on, did someone listen to our last episode and think my Willy Wonka joke was actually serious?
I'm pretty sure the show was a trigger.
Police say they have nothing to go on.
Oh, come on.
Oh, Graham.
Yeah, so the finger of suspicion is pointing in two ways at the moment. Thames Valley police think that a gang of thieves using at least two vehicles were responsible. A 66-year-old man has been detained in police custody, which is very worrying because, as recent news stories tell us, one of the consequences of having elderly thieves is that there'll be like about 70 different movies about this.
This is not like the Hatton Garden thing.
This is stupid Hatton Garden, no. Yes.
Don't you quash my dreams of Michael Caine descending from the ceiling on a wire to pick up a big gold toilet.
The other person who is being widely suspected is Maurizio Cattelan, who has had to furiously deny that he nicked his own 18-carat crapper.
But it's installed in Blenheim Palace.
Yeah,
which has security guards and security and stuff like that. I mean, it's not like when you go to work and you steal paper clips. Someone's going to notice if he's got a big gold toilet shoved up his jumper.
Oh, I know who's nicked it. The person who requested it to be borrowed.
Yes. Why has Trump not been? I want to say fingered, but I don't.
Don't think he hasn't been.
Yes,
surely it's him. He's the leader, yeah. Suspect.
You ask yourself who benefits, and then you realise this is a story about a golden toilet, and why are you asking serious questions about this?
Wait a minute. There's only one group I can think of who benefits from a golden toilet being stolen.
Oh?
Guys, did we steal the toilet?
Well, we need to have a little meeting, put it that way.
Yes.
I want to raise 2 points, number one and number two.
We need sit-down talks. This could run and run.
Don't forget to wipe the evidence.
We're really circling the ball this week.
You're embarrassing me. I feel flushed.
Toilet.
Cattelan.
I couldn't think of a joke and I wanted to be included.
The irony is somehow Andrew just coming in from left field and saying that was the funniest of all.
Yes.
Yeah, I've realised that all these years I've been putting far too much effort into this show. I can just have random words vaguely related to the story.
Cattelan has a bit of form with this. In 1996, when he had an exhibition in Amsterdam, he was given 2 weeks to produce all of the work for the exhibit, so he stole another artist's work from a nearby gallery and tried to pass it off as his own.
Flipping heck!
How did he steal another artist's work from a nearby gallery?
It's almost too slick a crime, isn't it? It's the sort of thing that somebody who is capable of stealing a gold toilet might be capable of pulling off.
Yeah, but, I mean, how did he get the art out of the gallery is my first question.
That's pretty brazen.
It's not just one picture or two pictures we're talking about. It's like an exhibition's worth. That's a lot of art.
What I really want to have happened in that case is for it to have gone to trial and for them to have a really pretentious defence attorney who just talks about the history of appropriative art and Marcel Duchamp and says that actually, rather than a crime, it was a comment on the mass-produced nature of his rival's work.
And do you think...
Oh, and Grandma said my history of art degree would never help me as a lawyer.
Do you think Catalan's tried to copy Banksy on this?
With the painting that got shredded?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if it's him, legally we have no evidence that it's him, but the sort of criminal mastermind who steals an entire exhibition is someone who I can't help but feel a bit suspicious about.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got to say who smelt it, they dealt it.
Okay, but in the movie version, it's definitely not the art thief who stole the art. That's not going to fill a two-hour runtime.
So, good work there, everyone, by the way. We really brought the show to the best possible opening. We also have an update from a story that we didn't cover. We were considering covering it, but we rejected it for being too depressing. And I kept it in mind and thought, at the moment, it's just depressing, but if someone does something really stupid, it could become a good lit light story. So here we go. The story that we reported on earlier was a 2018, well, that we didn't report on earlier, was a 2018 BuzzFeed report on complaints that performers at Punch Drunk, an immersive theatre company where the actors go into the audience and interact with the audience, had been groped and otherwise sexually assaulted by audience members. There were also allegations of the same thing happening at a non-Punch Drunk show that used similar methods, an adaptation of The Great Gatsby, and the people behind that one have come up with a new show. Now, I'd like to think that if you've had those allegations against you, you would choose something that does not foster a sexually coercive, anything goes kind of atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
They're doing The Wolf of Wall Street.
Whoa.
Right. I mean, they're doing an audience immersive Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes, yes, yes.
So they kind of embraced it rather than running 20 miles in the opposite direction.
It's the 2010s condition, isn't it? You turn into the skid, I guess.
Well, that's the hope, isn't it? Just, the audience is going to still be so blitzed out on all the free cocaine they give out at the start. they're not going to have the motor function.
Now, in fairness, Alexander Wright, the director of The Great Gatsby and The Wolf of Wall Street, said, when it happened in Gatsby, we just came down very hard for the next 3 days, something that I suspect may also happen after they finish The Wolf of Wall Street. But he continues, at the beginning of this show, we said, all right, look, this has happened to us. We laid out the rules and quickly made all the security systems and put them in place. Those systems include door security, personal alarm buttons for actors, a code word system to flag problematic audience members, CCTV cameras, plus a safeguarding consent and inclusion coordinator. Have they tried just doing it on a stage?
Yeah, not including the audience.
Yeah.
That's kind of their shtick, though, isn't it? If they're known for including, you're doing lots of audience participation, then how do they...
Yeah,
they sort of have to go back to being a regular theatre company, I guess.
That could be the next big thing, non-immersive theatre.
I mean,
come in, sit down, and don't participate in the show.
I mean, if they're going to go that far, why not just do audience immersive hair or something like that?
I think that would be good. I'm sure that they have taken this very seriously, and it sounds like they've put a lot of safeguards in place. But I think the audience who would go to a show that is essentially billed as go to one of Jordan Belfort's parties would be such a gang of caterwauling cocks. You know, it's
a way of getting more men to the theatre, maybe.
Maybe, yes.
I feel like that's the depressing core of all of this, isn't it? That it's the theatre company who are the fools. for building a system based around assuming people won't be just absolutely awful dumpsters that are on fire and filled with, like, radioactive jizz.
So, Avenue Q, then.
Yeah, so we were talking earlier about the news having some quite consistent themes this week, and I think we're going into a sort of corridor of lady news, a woman corridor. This, no, I've sorry.
Steady on there.
Yeah.
It have sounded we checked with the consent coordinated before we go in?
But yes, we have a lot of woman-centric news this week, including one of Britain's greatest 20th century writers has been recognised with a blue plaque on the house where she lived for the last 16 years of her life.
Well, thank goodness, finally someone's given Jane Austen the respect she deserves.
20th century!
Beatrix Potter?
I don't listen to the word you say, Graham.
Beatrix Potter? Yes.
No, if you wanted to troll me this hard, you could have said, you know, you could have said A.L. James, but...
See, I wanted to say God Margaret Atwood, but...
I could have said Ayn Rand. I had so many good options and I whiffed this one. I'm sorry, everyone, I apologise.
Yes, the house in question belonged to Angela Carter.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
This is the house where she wrote The Bloody Chamber, Nights at the Circus, and Wise Children. She also tutored her student, which included Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh, wow.
There is a wonderful sentence in this article from her friend Susanna Clapp about what the house was like, which I will now read. Downstairs was carnival. True, there was a serious kitchen. But there were also violins and marigold walls and scarlet paintwork. A kite hung from the ceiling of the sitting room. The shelves supported menageries of wooden animals. Books were piled on chairs. Birds, one of them looking like a ginger wig and called Carrot Top, were released from their cages to whirl through the air, balefully watched through the window by the household's salivating cats. They're free range, said Angela. It sounds like this should have been the immersive theatre experience, frankly.
That sounds so perfect for Angela Carter.
It's exactly what you imagine her house to be like, isn't
it? Yeah, magical.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention that because I love Angela Carter. And also it does provide us a way into the very lady-centric set of news that we have this week.
Yeah, I think I was just paused with confusion at there being just a nice story.
Yeah, it's a good story about a good person being recognised. How often do we get those?
Not enough. Not never enough.
I was having to seriously think there.
Yeah. Anyway, I can now reassure you that we are moving on to some incredibly dumb stuff.
Okay, good. Flip us back into the cesspool.
Yes.
Twitter has very strict regulations about what you can and cannot use as advertisements on its website. You know, if it's by a crank right-wing think tank funded by a series of shell companies somewhere between the Cayman Islands and St. Petersburg, great, we'll wave you through. If, on the other hand, you are planning to use the word vagina in your advert, that's a problem. And it's a particular problem when you are a gynecologist promoting your new book, The Vagina Bible, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine.
Wow, that's a title and a half.
Yeah.
Yes. It makes a statement that this is a book that will go deep. I'm sorry.
All of a sudden I'm remembering all those gynecology jokes from Robin Williams in Patch Adams.
I'm really sorry to bring the memory of Patch Adams back to you.
I mean, aside from the overly serious, dramatic Patch Adams bit, Robin Williams was great when he was just cracking jokes.
Oh, totally, yeah.
That being said, so much as Robin Williams was a foundational part of my childhood, and I love him dearly, can we not talk about him and vaginas in the same bit? Because that's just two images side by side in my head that I don't want together.
Oh dear. Well, the next story was going to be about my extensive collection of Bicentennial Man slash fic, but I guess that's going out the window.
I will be honest, I do have a big soft spot for that film.
Bicentennial Man?
Yep.
I've never seen it. I've never seen it.
I
remember the character design just weirding me out a bit.
I think there's a really sweet story in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that it's looking at it from a different perspective to the usual fare of, oh no, robots, we must run away from robots because they're big and scary and will kill us.
It's true.
Yeah, really hits that sweet spot. Anyway, speaking of vaginas.
Dr. Jennifer Gunter, for it is she, has come up with a new way of advertising it. Kensington Books promoted tweets now say, we're not allowed to say the name of the book in this ad, but trust us, you want it.
Right. That's vague and non-specific enough.
I mean, see, that's so vague, it could be anything from a new car to chocolate.
It also sounds substantially dirtier than just saying the vagina Bible.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just a body part.
In follow-up tweets, Dr. Gunter has said that she thinks the problem here is because of, and I quote, our societal inability to say vagina like we say elbow. It is true that Twitter need to learn the difference between their vagina and their elbow.
It's especially confusing considering Twitter is just one giant ass.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I was trying to put that comment in my head into words, and you did it for me. Thank you.
So, in other woman news, yes, the women have been busy this week. 30,000 people have signed a petition to the Oxford English Dictionary to cut entries that they say discriminate against and patronise women. Now, it should be apparent that I will read any old tonk for this show.
Where is your copy of Nazi Spoons of the Third Reich?
I still have it in a treasured place. It's just tucked behind the cistern of my 18-carat gold toilet. Oh, God, no! but this is the first time that I've first been alerted to a news story by it being on the front page of the Daily Star.
What?
Wow.
We really have fallen far this week.
I'm scraping the bottom of the toilet for that one.
As everyone knows, it's been a quiet time in British politics recently, so we can afford to have our newspapers cover stories of more trivial interest, such as this, and the Daily Star, which, like, every single day is something like, now snowflakes want to ban bread, I guess, or after Brexit we'll be able to show repeats of it ain't half hot, mum, and it'll be 1973 all the time. They have the predictable angle that this was a matter of snowflakes complaining to the dictionary rather than complaining on the front cover of a low circulation national newspaper like mature adults do. But I have to say, reading some of the entries singled out on the petition by Maria Beatrice Giovanardi, some of this is really dodgy.
Right.
On the one hand, it says the dictionary includes words like bitch, besom, piece, bit, mare, baggage, wench, petticoat, frail, bird, bint, biddy, and filly, which you may think, well, it's a dictionary, it's going to have words in. However,
I mean, some of those words that you mentioned are actual names for animals, rather than people.
Yes, yes, or dresses. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I don't object to them being in the dictionary. What I do think is a bit far is that those are included as synonyms for woman.
What?
I suppose in terms of usage, it sounds harsh, but they are used as synonyms.
Yeah, but
even though they're highly pejorative.
I mean, when was the last time you heard anybody outside of Mike Myers in So I Married an Axe Murderer refer to any woman as a fine filly?
You are on fire with the 90s comedy film.
And that was Mike Myers doing a dodgy Scottish accent and liking the Bay City Rollers.
Can we retroactively get Mike Myers' Scottish accent classified as problematic? I don't find it offensive. I just want him to stop.
It was very much a movie of its time. Put that comment on it.
I mean, you don't go out on a night out and hear a couple of lads who've had a few pints going, "Oh, look, there's a fine filly over there.
Oh, check out that Besom."
Besom?
The word frail.
Besom? How do you spell Besom?
B-E-S-O-M.
B-S-O-M.
Is it B-S?
Besom.
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 I think it's a synonym for a besom. It's a synonym for a broomstick, isn't it?
Is it? I've never heard that word before.
Didn't you say the word frail was one of them?
Yes.
Doesn't frail literally just mean weak?
Yes, it does.
Don't you normally use that to refer to the elderly and the infirm, rather than...
It's an adjective, not a noun.
Exactly.
That's kind of a problem.
You say they are frail because they're elderly and, you know, they're infirm. And they're infirm. You don't say...
No, I've heard certain sources where, like, men, as an insulting way, will refer to a woman as a frail.
I've never heard that.
It's X-Men comics. I heard it in X-Men comics.
Oh, God.
Is that what they're getting these from?
It may be.
Almost definitely. It's one of the synonyms, Dirty Mutie.
I've got a phrase going around in my head, delicate frail, and I'm sure I've heard that in a lyric or something like that.
Or a period drama.
Delicate frail.
It does sound like something...
Period, by the way. We can't advertise the show on Twitter if we say that too much.
All I'm saying is it does sound like the kind of language that, Mr. Darcy would use to refer to somebody of the opposite gender.
Since he's a dong. Yeah, yes. I got my Jane Austen dig in the end.
See, you say he's a dong, but I never knew he was Chinese.
As a member of the liberal elite who has nothing but double standards and hatred for straight white men, I am completely okay with dong being a synonym for men. sentences shown to demonstrate the use of the word woman include: Miss September will embody the professional, intelligent, yet sexy career woman, and I told you to be home when I get home, little woman.
Of all the sentences, there's so many other sentences.
There are sentences which have never been used in an Andy Capp strip that they could have used.
Yeah. And my first thought was, hang on, are we on kind of tricky ground here?
Usually, but in this particular instance, particularly.
I don't know. So why not just come up with totally new genders for everybody?
Yes.
You know, I'm going to change my gender to Fitbit.
Yes. I am Sasquatch.
Yeah.
I just think we need something that the Oxford English Dictionaries aren't in on already. That's quite a goal, isn't it?
Oh, God, no. We have to cut this whole segment.
Oh?
I've just realised. Mm-hmm. I've accidentally done a Ricky Gervais bit.
Yes. He's got a point. It's got to go.
On the plus side, we are getting a large some from Netflix for our crap old man opinions. So, you know, win-win. I think we should
do it. Come see Censored. I'm not allowed to say things I want anymore. My multi-million dollar TV special.
excellent impersonation, Andrew, but you've made a mistake. The special is not called Triggered, like all of the other ones of these always are.
You're right, that's why I'll never be a professional comedian.
Yes.
So, are we now officially protesting words?
Completely, yes.
Okay. And that's why the rest of this show will be in mime.
Yes. I think regular listeners will know that we have a deep contempt for language in all its forms.
I'm not going to disagree.
Yeah.
Speaking of people who hate language and want less of it about, Facebook has applied to trademark the word book.
Yes. They apparently successfully trademarked the word face. How do you trademark the word face?
I know.
That's terrifying, isn't it?
It is terrifying. It's like as bad as trying to copyright rice, which they've also done in America.
Have they?
Yeah. They tried to copyright cereal and trademark the rice. They got to patent on rice, a particular rice that they'd made.
I mean,
wow.
What do I call the front side of my head from now on?
You can't call it anything, or you'll. Be forced to pay a fine to Mark Zuckerberg, who could obviously use the money.
I mean, if I ever see Mark Zuckerberg's front side of his head, I'll punch him in the balls, and it won't be long until they copyright the word balls, so I'll have to say, I'll punch him in the groin, and then they'll copyright the word groin.
The only way we can get around this is by using words that are banned from social media advertising.
Okay, considering how much we hate words, I have to ask, which version of the word book are they copywriting? Is it the book as in the book that you read, or is it the book as in booking a flight?
Yes, that's another ambiguity that they haven't cleared up.
There must be a very large document to outline the exact precise usage. I'm wondering if it's just within, you know, directly following the word face.
Is this the kind of document is this the kind of document that may consist of multiple pages and could be found in libraries?
I'm glad you said that, because there's a lovely turn of phrase in this Telegraph article by Lawrence Dodds, which says, if it is approved, the term book, which originally referred to an archaic paper-based data storage format...
Nice.
It will join other trademarked words such as face, like, wall, pork... Tax evasion. Oh, no, not tax evasion. Sorry, how did that get in there?
Hang on. Pork has been copyrighted.
Pork is, in fairness, a word that has fallen from use dramatically after everyone just exhausted the humour potential of it when Facebook launched.
Yeah.
Yeah, that didn't last so long. And it was just like, come on, we're not using that.
It's now a joke so overused that double entendres about pork do not appear in any Ricky Gervais stand-up specials.
Well, this is how overused it is. You could say the word pork to me repeatedly and I wouldn't laugh, and you know my mind is in the gutter.
That's bleak, isn't it? It's
You know, I'm surprised that dystopian fiction still sells so well, considering we're already living in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we all sort of laughed when this was a story about some romance author trying to trademark the word cocky. But these people have expensive lawyers who were good at their job. So yeah, this unfortunately takes us into the second micro bit of the show, which is about censorship. We get so many stories about censorship nowadays, largely because there has been a very well-funded exercise to turn it into a synonym for disagreeing with newspaper columnists. But there are still genuine cases of censorship out there. This week in America, it is Banned Book Week, where the American Library Association releases its list of the most frequently challenged books. John Oliver's A Day in the Life of Marlon Brando is still riding high.
Yep. That's not going to get off that list anytime soon.
It's quite impressive, really, isn't it? I mean, the book is a tie-in for a comedy TV series. It would probably go away of its own accord if people didn't make a fuss about it.
Yeah.
Isn't it? I've just forgotten what it's about, that one. Is it to do with Trump?
No, it's yeah, Mike Pence's
rabbit.
Oh,
turns out
yeah. That's it. Oh, yeah. That's it.
And it's also got a lot of other big hitters of the subgenre, like The Hate U Give and The Absolutely True Diaries of Part-Time Indian, which are always on these lists. Something that I say every single time this comes up, and I will continue saying this until everyone gets the message, is that for all of the talk about how the real censorship's with all the political correctness you've got now, I look over these lists every year for masses of people challenging books for, say, having problematic opinions about non-binary people or expressing support for the National Rifle Association. Every year I look for these armies of censorious liberals and I do not find them.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though, with liberals, they aren't. That's not their vibe.
No, it's not their vibe. Otherwise, they would have immediately, as soon as the NRA started working on revisionist children's fables.
No, really? Holy mother.
Did you not hear about this? I think it was last year or the year before.
You remember substantially this? Less good than Angela Carter's attempts at the same thing.
You remember these, don't you, Graham? And I know you do, Andrew. The NRA's version of, say, Hansel and Gretel and various things like that. Where Hansel and Gretel both had like assault rifles or something, and were used to hunting.
But I mean, I don't get it, Graham. If there aren't these armies of liberals trying to ban everything that like the NRA or other right wing organizations put out, what are you saying? Because surely it can't be that the organizations themselves deliberately drumming up all this controversy to get their potential customers all riled up and increase the sales of the products they produce. Oh, no, wait.
That is exactly it. Yes. Yeah. Whereas John Oliver, he comes by his controversy the honest way, by writing something that will offend silly people and waiting until silly people get offended.
Oh, like when he set up his own religion.
Yes.
Did he do that as well?
Yeah. He gets away with all sorts on TV and they let him because he's British. Seriously, I think that is the key to his success is just the fact that he's British. And so they look at him and go, oh, it's fine. He's British. We expect that. You know, they're all weird over there. And we are.
But we do have another story about a book banning. But it's a book banning in, I think, the smallest and most pathetic register that it is possible to do. If, like, the lawsuit over Lady Chatterley's Lover was the 1812 overture, this is someone playing La Cucaracha on a kazoo. Yes.
Love the analogy.
Thank you. A sports bookshop in Newcastle upon Tyne called The Back Page.
Oh, you can stop there, I'm already done.
It has announced that it will not stock the new memoir from the footballer Michael Owen, which I regret to inform you is called Reboot. After he wrote that he was reluctant to move from Real Madrid to Newcastle United in 2005, saying, I don't need to justify myself to f***ing Newcastle fans.
Which is a fair comment.
Wow, Michael Owen.
PR disaster, Michael Owen.
Yeah, but
no wonder you're cancelling your series and starting an entirely new comic universe.
I thought the book you know, being called Reboot was some kind of novelization of that really strange 90s cartoon, or was it noughties cartoon?
Yeah, look, Oliver, I did have a temporary kind of blue screen of trying to decide what's funnier. Michael Owen, like, having to entirely change his origin story for the modern age, or getting sucked into, like, a terrible 90s CGI computer world to fight the terror of the online menace known only as Megabyte.
He can only defeat him with his football skills, of which the main football skill he had was running really fast.
In fairness, there are worse skills to have in the game of football.
Well, not too fair, his specialist skills are running really fast and blowing his knee out all the damn time.
Yeah.
Surprise.
No. Now
I know a football thing. Yeah,
now I am seriously impressed by Andrew.
Oh, whenever I hear the name Michael Owen, I just have a little voice in my head that just goes, little Michael Owen.
It's all alone.
Just little Michael Owen.
Can I just point one thing out, right? This whole thing is predicated on him moving to Newcastle from Real Madrid.
Yeah.
So, what person in their right mind would move from the sunny climate of Spain, especially Madrid, you know, where he's basically living a decent life and getting paid a lot of money, to Newcastle?
Was he transferred? I mean,
I am not as into football as Andrew obviously is, but I have made copious notes on this. And I think one aspect of his reluctance is that Real Madrid is... it's good. Good team. It's very prestigious to play for.
And they have loads of money because, if I remember rightly, one of their owners is the King of Spain.
Wow.
So we're off censorship. We're off censorship. We're moving on to people who have perhaps said a bit too much now.
So us then.
Yes. There has been a scandal in the world of online influencing.
So still us then.
Oh my God. Oh, that hurts too much, Rob.
Is this going to be a scandal that we kind of know about already? Like when a YouTuber will recommend an eyeshadow and shock horror, she doesn't really use the eyeshadow. She's been paid to recommend it.
It is a bit like that. I want to make sure that everyone is sit down and in a secure, preferably padded room.
Yeah, I've got a nice soft area here. Yeah.
I don't know about the eyeshadow thing because I stopped watching all those videos after I got through my goth phase.
Oh, I hope there are photos. yes, Caroline Calloway, the online Instagram influencer, does not write all her own text.
Wow. Yes.
All right, when you say text, are we on about on her phone or does she...
She has somebody who texts for her. One of her entourage.
Keep her thumbs pristine. No, ghostwriter Natalie Beach has written an essay in The Cut, which for my sins I have read all of, and if you can work out which one of them comes off the worst from it, I think you have...
Oh, is her blog entitled Life's a Beach?
Well, like I say, up until recently, her blog was entitled Caroline Calloway's Instagram Feed. That is definitely all written by Caroline Calloway. Calloway has been controversial in the world of influencing for a while. To quote a piece from Natalie Beach's Cut essay, Caroline fell out of the public eye for a year, but returned this past January on a tour to promote her creativity workshop, which was billed as a tutorial to, architect a life that feels really full and genuine and rich and beautiful, but ended up being compared to a one-woman fire festival. She charged participants $165 a head, sold the tickets before booking venues, made promises of orchard crowns and cooked salad that she couldn't deliver on, and posted the whole fiasco in real time.
Oh my god.
I hate every single word of this story.
Well, it's obviously a learning curve.
I think there is a real opportunity for growth here.
Yeah, like spiritually, there's a message there.
Guys, it's just made me so humble, like even more humble than I used to be, which was very bloody humble indeed.
That was very humble.
Can I just,
you were the most humble of everybody.
Can I just point out the whole message of adversity breeds strength doesn't apply here.
No. Yeah, but I'm sure she's also very sorry if anyone felt they were hurt or offended by her actions.
Also, architect as a verb, not even the Oxford English Dictionary would stoop that low. So yeah, I read the whole of Beach's confessional, and whereas Calloway is certainly a fraud, Beach comes across as deeply insufferable. She talks about them both working out who would try and seduce their lecturer because, as she claims in the most New York upper class sentence ever written, he was soon to be played by Jesse Eisenberg in a movie. And she claims that she got very angry with other people on her creative writing course when they didn't agree that Instagram captions were a legitimate new genre of autobiography.
They're not!
Yeah.
Wow.
Was she running the creative writing course?
No. I mean, she might have been ghostwriting the lecturer's notes, but no.
Thank God for that. I have this thing about creative writing courses, as you know, Graham.
Yes, and I don't blame you for it at all.
So you don't like them?
Mostly no.
You think they're a ripoff?
Mostly yes. I think that most of the stuff that they teach is stuff that you could learn yourself if you applied yourself and actually tried.
Well, that's a comment that might prove somewhat pathetic later on.
Now, the Calloway Beach feud has prompted the most 2010s internet of After Effects in that there is already a quiz up on BuzzFeed asking if you were more a Caroline or a Natalie. Normally, we do a lot of quizzes on this show, but I couldn't bring myself to put it in front of you. But it has also sparked this very good Guardian article by Alison Flood about feuds between ghostwriters and their subjects, including famously the Tony Schwartz, who ghostwrote Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal, later said that he deeply regretted that.
Wow.
Andrew O'Hagan got on so badly with Julian Assange that he published his draft of Assange's autobiography as Julian Assange, the unauthorized autobiography.
Wow.
But I think my favorite bit of this is right at the end, where she has interviewed a ghostwriter called Andrew Crofts about his experiences in the industry. And it finishes with more than 80 books behind him, a dozen of which were number one bestsellers, Crofts can only recall having to sever ties with one subject himself. He was an elderly gentleman, and I remember him coming out of the shower naked, he says. He had all the photographs for the books spread out on the floor, and they were sticking to his feet, and I thought, it's time to go.
Wow. Weird.
Just who, though? Who was the old man?
Yeah. See, it doesn't say when that was, so it could be anyone who was ever been in their 80s. It rules out Justin Bieber.
I was going to say, it rules out Ricky Gervais then, doesn't it?
Oh, God, thank you for that mental image.
I say Prince Philip, can we be tried for treason?
Nah, I think it's only if you talk about the Queen.
Yes.
I mean, who cares who the consort is?
So final story of the week, and we have looped back artfully, literally artfully, to the world of silly conceptual art.
Awesome. Always good.
Yep. The artist and poet Kenneth Goldsmith has created an installation at the new Venice Biennale called Hillary, the Hillary Clinton Emails, which is a desk containing the full transcripts of Hillary Clinton's emails.
Even the sexy ones?
Were there any sexy ones? Does she even do that?
That's why it was more a question than a statement.
As far as I remember, they were all about the dairy industry, hence the regular chant, butter emails.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Boo, Graham.
That was a new low.
That was worse.
I expect you to be better than that, Graham.
That was worse than one of mine.
I like the little eye of the hurricane there as everyone just came to terms with the quality of
the Oh, it definitely made my stomach churn, that one.
Goldsmith's work has been controversial in the past, but he has found a high-profile champion of his work who stopped to read out some of the emails recently, Hillary Clinton.
Ah, nice.
Who tweeted, "Found my emails at the Venice Biennale. Someone alert the House GOP."
Oh, no.
Did she definitely read her own email? Did she definitely write her own emails, or did she have a ghostwriter?
Yes. It was Natalie Beach again.
I know we all hoped she kind of disappeared off into the mountains, never to be seen again, but God damn it, hip-relatable Hillary is back into his house.
You know she can't stay in the mountains, because then it's just her and Bill, and that's just, oh, War of the Roses all over again.
But yes, she read out a selection of her greatest hits, including memos about her time as foreign secretary, some stuff regarding the election campaign, how to set up a satanic child sacrifice.
Hang on a minute, back it up there a little bit. So did you say it was on a desk?
It was at a replica of the Resolute desk from the Oval Office.
The Resolute desk?
It's such a desk. It's being a desk so hard. It intends to continue being a desk for as long as you want it.
It's all desk. 100% of the time, it's so desk.
Is this like the full-on replica of the desk? So if I pop a certain mechanism, it'll come out with a little thing that I can use to find the secret treasure of the, I don't know, whatever cult it was.
Sierra Madre?
Yeah.
No. Have you guys not seen National Treasure?
Yeah, I was about to. Are you referencing National Treasure?
Yes.
Adventure film.
Yes, I am.
Excellent. I'm pretty sure it's like the Lost Scroll of Benjamin Franklin or something, isn't it?
Apparently, it was like the Masonic treasure or something like that. There's scrolls from the Library of Alexandria and all sorts of stuff apparently in there.
Maybe. I mean, it could be that I'm thinking of National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets.
Oh, God, yeah, you're thinking of that one.
The only thing I know about National Treasure 2, Book of Secrets, is that Helen Mirren has such an 80s perm in it.
Yes.
Oh, wow, I've not seen it, but that sounds awesome. I might watch it just for that.
I'm a big believer that movies are made by their haircuts. So yes, that's about wound up the news section of the story. Do we have a review?
Yes, Graham, I've got the book.
You forget
to bring a book, two shows on the trot, and this is what it gets you. So yeah, I'm just launching into this.
Yeah, when are you ready?
I mean, can anyone ever truly be ready
for this jelly?
Anyway, I've been reading Spider-Man Forever Young by Stefan Fuchsia.
Wow.
Yes, that book that I keep saying I have been reading and will cover at some point.
I mean, I can't talk, to be honest. I've been reading Animal by Sarah Pascoe for a long time. Sorry, Graham, it's your book.
It's fine.
Future societies are going to be split pre and post Sarah reading Animal by Sarah Pascoe. With just kind of the lost years in between.
The dark ages.
Wilderness years.
So yeah, this is an official Marvel novel based on the classic Stone Tablet Saga comics, which classic is an optimistic word they've used. But not that they're necessarily bad comics. It's just I feel like when people are talking about the great Spider-Man stories, that one time he had to fight a really old man from getting like the elixir of youth from a special tablet. A big stone tablet, not like a paracetamol.
Yes.
Is maybe not among them.
Is that the one where, is that the Aztec stone tablet thing that was on top of the pyramid?
I think it's a Mayan tablet or something.
Mayan, Aztec, same kind of area.
Oh, big extinct civilization racist.
No, I think they did that story in the Spider-Man cartoon.
Probably.
The fox kids.
Where are the Mayans from?
South America.
Are they?
Well, there were actually aliens that parked in South America.
Of course, yeah.
Obviously, yes. Yeah. Sorry, duh.
The History Channel said it, so it must be true. But yeah, so this story follows Spider-Man Peter Parker. He's in college, having his classic Peter Parker problems, you know. His bent's late and he's got to see Aunt May and he's got to make time for Gwen Stacy, but he keeps blowing her off and so she's mad at him and he's failing all his classes.
It's a perfectly valid euphemism for not seeing someone.
Sorry. We're all going to go lame gag crazy, then I'm in there. I'm here for that.
Are you done? Is that out your system?
Sorry, Andrew.
Good. This is a serious arts and book show, Sarah. So anyway, Spider-Man. He's got radioactive spider powers. He gets involved in a plot between the Kingpin, who is a gangster, who is fat in ways that are maybe now slightly uncomfortable.
Unless you're a sumo wrestler.
Yeah, it's fine. It's all muscle, baby.
Well,
and maybe Spider-Man cracking constant fat jokes. That's fine.
No, that's not
hurtful
good.
And problematic in this day and age.
That's not good. I mean, if it was somebody shouting those things at me, I'd A, punch them in the balls, and B, start crying. In that order.
Yeah, so Kingpin wants it, as does a gangster named Silvermane, who is the aforementioned old man. His superpower is being old.
But, just hold on one second. Didn't the Vulture grow younger by absorbing the life force of people at one point?
Yes, look. If we're going to talk about Spider-Man plots that have no relevance to this story, we're going to be here all day. Although, speaking of that, that does dovetail nicely into a weird criticism of this book, is that it seems weirdly like devoted to adapting the actual story of the comics.
Right.
Including a bit where, like, basically at the start, Peter meets up with his friend Harry Osborn, who is the son of the Green Goblin. Mm. And basically they have a big chat about, you know, how no one's seen Norman for a while and he's worried that something might have happened to him.
Mm.
Which, in the comics, is of course setting up the fact that Norman's slipped back into his Green Goblin persona and that, you know, sets off the chain of events that eventually leads to Gwen Stacy's death. In the book, that's a plot point that's not really followed up on at all.
Right.
It's a weird choice that it adapts just the actual content of the comics rather than, you know, taking like the basic story and reworking it into something that works as a standalone novel.
Because
also, I did tell a bit of a lie. The Green Goblin killing Gwen Stacy does factor into this book a little tiny bit. Because this book has a part one and a part two, part one ending kind of where this original comic story from the 60s ends with, you know, Spider-Man, he beats Silvermane. Well, Silvermane actually uses the tablet, starts getting younger. You know, classic fantasy film thing, starts getting younger and younger, ages until he's just like a baby and then vanishes into nothing. And yeah, end of story. Everything's hunky-dory. Smash cut to part two, 2 years later. Literally starts with Spider-Man being all, oh, Gwen Stacy's dead, I'm sad now.
Oh, God.
Because it also adapts, like, another comic book story from a few years later.
Right.
And that's what I mean by it being, like, a really weird choice to just have, like, the story stop and then pick up again with this. By the way, a bunch of stuff happened in between chapters.
Yes. Boy, has it been a busy summer.
Yeah, half the cast is dead and Harry Osborn's a drug addict now. Yeah, so that's one of the big criticisms I'd have of this book. Another one, I would say, I think, again, I hinted at it earlier, is there's a few story beats that, like, as much as this book has tried to adapt things into the modern day by, like, having characters have mobile phones and stuff, there's a lot of, like, 60s-era stuff that's quite problematic, especially with regards to female characters. And I think one of the big things that I really realised is, you know, Peter having this whole thing of, oh, no, I love Gwen Stacy, but she's all mad at me because I keep, you know, abandoning our dates to go do Spider-Man stuff, but I can't tell her I'm Spider-Man. So I just have to make up these, you know, half-hearted excuses. I think the main reason why comics don't really do that now is that's quite a bit like gaslighting.
Yes.
Very much the, what, when you think I keep running away from you? No, you're the crazy one.
I should just invented it. How about you go and have a lie down in a nice lady room?
Yeah, it is just a bit of spaghetti-o. And thirdly, to kind of wind up the trifecta of problems I have with this book, it's the thing I foreshadowed with Rob, in that this is very much written by a man who has completed a creative writing course.
Right.
See what I mean?
I think it's a problem I've kind of come across with quite a few things that I get given for this show of you can always tell when they've had that same kind of course training.
Right.
Just because everything reads a bit like you can tell they have been told this is how you structure a story.
Yeah.
Rather than like developing their own style.
It's kind of like, you know how when you're in school and you're doing science in school and they tell you to do your science report in a certain way.
Yeah.
So when you get to university, if you're still doing science, you probably won't use that, but it's in your head that that is the structure, the basic structure that you follow. And that's my biggest problem with creative writing courses, is that they really, really dampen your own style. They force you to, like, adopt a style that's not yours.
Yeah, and you can always tell when, like, they've been told, okay, it's the start of a new chapter, so you need to introduce the characters and set up the scene. So it's like literally every chapter always starts with, Peter walked into the room. It was a big room. There was a coffee cup on the table. And what is the bane of my life with books like this, which is the need to describe every single minute detail of every single scene.
Oh, yes, the Tolstoy approach.
Like, I think there's one ridiculous bit where Spider-Man, like, he has to go rescue a scientist who's been captured by Silvermane, and so he starts crawling along the wall to get to him, and he could just write Spider-Man crawled along the wall, but nope, gotta be like, Spider-Man pushed his elbow out and splayed his fingers apart. You know,
yeah,
gripping onto the wall, he pulled his arm forward, then he put his other arm forward.
This is definitely the, like, Tolstoy approach.
And especially in the more, like, action-oriented scenes, it's a lot of, you know, missing the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
But you're focusing so much on like the tiny details of how Spider-Man's moving every part of his body, kind of lose the thread of like what's actually going on in the scene.
Oh God, now I'm just imagining how he'd describe that, you know, the Korean Spider-Man statue. Spider-Man's muscles bulged in an unfortunate way.
That being said, I think it is still essentially just a fun little Spider-Man story. Like, I think Stefan Petrucci, you know, he makes the characters sound like the characters. Yeah. But it's hard to credit him too much with, you know, the plot or anything, since he mostly just seems to be copying things that, like, Stan Lee and I think Jerry Conway wrote.
Yeah, because it was the original Forever Young, the Stone Tablet saga was 1960s, wasn't it?
Yeah. Actually, no. The original Stone Tablet saga is slightly famous as a Spider-Man story, because that was one of the ones that Steve Ditko, not Stan Lee, scripted.
Ah.
And so you've got a weird bit where, like, Spider-Man sees a bunch of protesters and gets super, like, randy in on them. You know, damn protesters, they should be getting a job, earning for themselves.
Right, okay, I was a little bit confused as to what you actually said there.
Yeah, I also heard randy, which would be a much better story.
I was like, randy in was not the best choice of words, but yeah, the point still stands. Steve Ditko, influential, like, responsible for some great comic characters. Bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I think the way this book works best is if you're a fan of these comics and want what is like essentially a director's cut of the story. Because, you know, this beefs out certain things. Something I do like that it does is it has chapters from this perspective of characters who aren't Spider-Man. So you get a bit like from Silvermane. He's quite a fun character because, like, yeah, he's this Magia boss who's clearly past it and, like, is even starting to lose his mind a bit, but is really determined, like, no, he doesn't want to show any weakness at all. Even, like, when he forgets, like, what his main lieutenant's name is.
And,
yeah.
Or what the important task he sent him off to do is.
Did you say Magia boss?
Yes, Magia. Oh, yeah, that's a thing. So back in the 1960s, Marvel legally weren't allowed to call their gangs the Mafia.
Did the Mafia, like, launch a Facebook-style copyright suit or something?
No, this was back when it was probably like, the Mafia is a legitimate business organization, so we will sue any company that dare suggest we might be involved in illegitimate exercises.
Because the problem I've got is now in a post-Harry Potter world, right, the word Magia usually refers to something to do with wizards or magic or something like that.
I thought you just meant Hungarian.
Oh, Silvermane, leader of the Hungarian wizards.
Yeah, that's about all I have to say about this book. Bit of a mixed bag.
So we know what you've been reading, and we know what Sarah's been reading.
Slowly.
Well, what Sarah's still reading.
What Sarah is still projected to be reading for some time. Rob, what have you been reading?
In my defence, I'm not reading one book at a time, though.
It's fine, yeah.
I've been reading trash.
Right.
I mean, quite literally, it's trash fiction. I'm still on my Eastern trash fiction binge.
Right.
I don't know. I ended up reading something called Valhalla Saga, which is about a Korean pro gamer who dies and ends up in Valhalla. It's very Nordic and very, very trashy. And I'll be honest, I kind of liked it because it was all about Ragnarok and you had Thor and everyone like that. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. Thor's here.
That's good. I'm excited to announce that I've been reading and loving Milkman by Anna Burns.
Right, what's that about?
Is it about
a milkman?
It is about a milkman. We were discussing it before and we decided it probably was a gritty retelling of the Pat Mustard episode of Father Ted.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm. It's the one that won the Booker a few years back, and Anna Burns, the writer, famously said that the first thing she'd have to do after this was contact the DWP and tell them that she'd just had a pretty incredible change of circumstances. And cool. Milkman is a tale of an 18-year-old girl who's being stalked by what she initially interprets as an old perv in her unnamed Northern Irish village, but she later comes to realise might be tied up with some wider aspect of the Troubles, that he might be a sort of a made man, as the Magia would say.
Right.
And it's excellent. It's so great. It's the best new novel I've read since Hilary Mantel's Beyond Black. I love it so much.
Oh, wow.
It's got a lot of pressing. It was a very difficult novel when it came out, but the thing that is most ostentatiously experimental about it is the fact that none of the characters have names. They just have descriptions, which, if you've got terrible memory for people's names like me, makes it less difficult than a normal novel.
Oh, that's cool. I would probably enjoy that more.
Mm. Oh my God, it's just like all the people I know in real life.
So anyway, should we wind it up?
Yeah.
Yes, we should. Smart host.
Oh, okay, right. So if you want to catch any of our other episodes of Literary Loitering, or indeed any of the other shows that are part of the Geek Show podcast family, then you can find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, where you'll also find video game reviews, movie reviews, and all sorts of other stuff, as well as our Patreon and our shop. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, if you want to get involved, or you just want some information about who we are and what we do, then do get in touch with us. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Just look for The Geek Show. Until next time, then, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
I've been Sarah.
And I've been Graham.
Nearly.
Yeah. And we will see you all later.
Bye. Thanks for listening.